Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Chapter 18 of The Magic of Oz by L. Frank Baum. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 18. The Magic of the Wizard. He first set up a small silver tripod and placed a gold basin at the top of it. Into this basin he put two powders, a pink one and a sky blue one, and poured over them a yellow liquid from a crystal vial. Then he mumbled some magic words, and the powders began to sizzle and burn and send out a cloud of violet smoke that floated across the river and completely enveloped both Trot and Cap'n Bill, as well as the toadstools on which they sat, and even the magic plant in the gold flower pot. Then, after the smoke had disappeared into the air, the wizard called out to the prisoners, "Are you free?" Both Trot and Cap'n Bill tried to move their feet and failed. "No!" they shouted in answer. The wizard rubbed his bald head thoughtfully and then took some other magic tools from the bag. First he placed a little black ball in a silver pistol and shot it toward the magic isle. The ball exploded just over the head of Trot and scattered a thousand sparks over the little girl. "Oh," said the wizard, "I guess that will set her free." But Trot's feet were still rooted in the ground of the magic isle, and the disappointed wizard had to try something else. For almost an hour he worked hard, using almost every magic tool in his black bag, and still Cap'n Bill and Trot were not rescued. "Dear me," exclaimed Dorothy, "I'm afraid we'll have to go to Glinda after all." That made the little wizard blush, for it shamed him to think that his magic was not equal to that of the magic isle. "I won't give up yet, Dorothy," he said, "for I know a lot of wizardry that I haven't yet tried. I don't know what magician enchanted this little island or what his powers were, but I do know that I can break any enchantment known to the ordinary witches and magicians that used to inhabit the Land of Oz. It's like unlocking a door. All you need is to find the right key."
"But suppose you haven't the right key with you," suggested Dorothy. "What then?"
"Then we'll have to make the key," he answered. The Glass Cat now came back to their side of the river, walking under the water, and said to the wizard,
"They're getting frightened over there on the island, because they're both growing smaller every minute. Just now, when I left them, both Trot and Cap'n Bill were only about half their natural sizes."
"I think," said the wizard reflectively, "that I'd better go to the shore of the island, where I can talk to them and work to better advantage. How did Trot and Cap'n Bill get to the island?"
"On a raft," answered the Glass Cat. "It's over there now on the beach."
"I suppose you're not strong enough to bring the raft to this side, are you?"
"No, I couldn't move it an inch," said the cat.
"I'll try to get it for you," volunteered the Cowardly Lion. "I'm dreadfully scared for fear the magic isle will capture me too, but I'll try to get the raft and bring it to this side for you." "Thank you, my friend," said the wizard.
So the lion plunged into the river and swam with powerful strokes across to where the raft was beached upon the island. Placing one paw on the raft, he turned and struck out with his other three legs, and so strong was the great beast that he managed to drag the raft from off the beach and propel it slowly to where the wizard stood on the river bank.
"Good!" exclaimed the little man, well pleased.
"May I go across with you?" asked Dorothy.
The wizard hesitated.
"If you'll take care not to leave the raft or step foot on the island, you'll be quite safe," he decided. So the wizard told the hungry tiger and the cowardly lion to guard the cage of monkeys until he returned, and then he and Dorothy got upon the raft. The paddle which Cap'n Bill had made was still there, so the little wizard paddled the clumsy raft across the water and ran it upon the beach of the Magic Isle, as close to the place where Cap'n Bill and Trot were rooted as he could. Dorothy was shocked to see how small the prisoners had become, and Trot said to her friends, "If you can't save us soon, there'll be nothing left of us."
"Be patient, my dear," counseled the wizard, and took the little axe from his black bag.
"What are you going to do with that?" asked Cap'n Bill.
"It's a magic axe," replied the wizard, "and when I tell it to chop, it will chop those roots from under your feet, and you can run to the raft before they grow again."
"Don't!" shouted the sailor in alarm. "Don't do it! Those roots are all flesh roots, and our bodies are feeding them while they're growing into the ground."
"To cut off the roots," said Trot, "would be like cutting off our fingers and toes." The wizard put the little axe back in the black bag and took out a pair of silver pincers.
"Grow, grow, grow," he said to the pincers,
and at once they grew and extended until they reached from the raft to the prisoners.
"What are you going to do now?" demanded Cap'n Bill,
fearfully eyeing the pincers.
"This magic tool will pull you up, roots and all, and land you on this raft," declared the wizard.
"Don't do it," pleaded the sailor with a shudder. "It would hurt us awfully."
"It would be just like pulling teeth to pull us up by the roots," explained Trot.
"Grow small," said the wizard to the pincers, and at once they became small, and he threw them into the black bag.
"I guess, friends, it's all up with us this time," remarked Cap'n Bill with a dismal sigh.
"Please tell Ozma, Dorothy," said Trot, "that we got into trouble trying to get her a nice birthday present. Then she'll forgive us. The magic flower is lovely and wonderful, but it's just a lure to catch folks on this dreadful island and then destroy them. You'll have a nice birthday party without us, I'm sure, and I hope, Dorothy, that none of you in the Emerald City will forget me or dear old Cap'n Bill."
End of chapter 18.
Chapter 19 of The Magic of Oz by L. Frank Baum. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 19. Dorothy and the Bumblebees. Dorothy was greatly distressed and had hard work to keep the tears from her eyes.
"Is that all you could do, wizard?"
she asked the little man.
"It's all I can think of just now," he replied sadly. "But I intend to keep on thinking as long as thinking will do any good."
They were all silent for a time, Dorothy and the wizard sitting thoughtfully on the raft, and Trot and Cap'n Bill sitting thoughtfully on the toadstools and growing gradually smaller and smaller in size. Suddenly Dorothy said, "Wizard, I've thought of something."
"What have you thought of?" he asked, looking at the little girl with interest.
"Can you remember the magic word that transforms people?" she asked.
"Of course," said he.
"Then you can transform Trot and Cap'n Bill into birds or bumblebees, and they can fly away to the other shore,
When they're there, you can transform 'em into their regular shapes again.
Can you do that, Wizard? Asked Cap'n Bill eagerly.
I think so.
Roots and all? Inquired Trot.
Why, the roots are now a part of you, and if you were transformed to a bumblebee, the whole of you would be transformed, of course, and you'd be free of this awful island.
All right, do it, cried the sailor man.
So the wizard said slowly and distinctly, I want Trot and Cap'n Bill to become bumblebees. Pirzqxgl.
Fortunately, he pronounced the magic word in the right way, and instantly Trot and Cap'n Bill vanished from view, and up from the places where they had been flew two bumblebees.
Hooray! Shouted Dorothy in delight. They're saved!
I guess they are, agreed the wizard, equally delighted. The bees hovered over the raft an instant, and then flew across the river to where the lion and the tiger waited. The wizard picked up the paddle and paddled the raft across as fast as he could. When he reached the river bank, both Dorothy and the wizard leaped ashore, and the little man asked excitedly, Where are the bees?
The bees? Inquired the lion, who was half asleep and did not know what had happened on the magic isle.
Yes, there were two of them.
Two bees?
Said the hungry tiger, yawning.
Why, I ate one of them, and the cowardly lion ate the other.
Goodness gracious! Cried Dorothy, horrified.
It was little enough for our lunch, remarked the tiger, but the bees were the only things we could find.
How dreadful!
Wailed Dorothy, wringing her hands in despair.
You've eaten Trot and Cap'n Bill!
But just then she heard a buzzing overhead, and two bees alighted on her shoulder.
Here we are, said a small voice in her ear. I'm Trot, Dorothy.
And I'm Cap'n Bill, said the other bee.
Dorothy almost fainted with relief, and the wizard, who was close by and had heard the tiny voices, gave a laugh and said,
You are not the only two bees in the forest, it seems. But I advise you to keep away from the lion and the tiger until you regain your proper forms.
Do it now, wizard, advised Dorothy. They're so small that you can never tell what might happen to 'em.
So the wizard gave the command and pronounced the magic word, and in the instant Trot and Cap'n Bill stood beside them as natural as before they had met their fearful adventure. For they were no longer small in size, because the wizard had transformed them from bumblebees into the shapes and sizes that nature had formerly given them. The ugly roots on their feet had disappeared with the transformation. While Dorothy was hugging Trot, and Trot was softly crying because she was so happy, the wizard shook hands with Cap'n Bill and congratulated him on his escape. The old sailor man was so pleased that he also shook the lion's paw and took off his hat and politely bowed to the cage of monkeys. Then Cap'n Bill did a curious thing. He went to a big tree and, taking out his knife, cut away a big, broad piece of thick bark. Then he sat down on the ground and, after taking a roll of stout cord from his pocket, which seemed to be full of all sorts of things, he proceeded to bind the flat piece of bark to the bottom of his good foot over the leather sole.
"What's that for?" inquired the wizard.
"I hate to be stumped," replied the sailor man, "so I'm going back to that island."
"And get enchanted again?" exclaimed Trot with evident disapproval.
"No, this time I'll dodge the magic of the island. I noticed that my wooden leg didn't get stuck or take root, and neither did the glass feet of the glass cat. It's only a thing that's made of meat, like man and beasts, that the magic can hold and root to the ground. Our shoes are leather, and leather comes from a beast's hide. Our stockings are wool, and wool comes from a sheep's back. So when we walked on the magic isle, our feet took root there and held us fast. but not my wooden leg. So now I'll put a wooden bottom on my other foot, and the magic can't stop me."
"But why do you wish to go back to the island?" asked Dorothy.
"Didn't you see the magic flower in the gold flower pot?" returned Cap'n Bill.
"Of course I saw it, and it's lovely and wonderful.
Well, Trot and I set out to get this magic plant for a present to Ozma on her birthday, and I mean to get it and take it back with us to the Emerald City."
"That would be fine," cried Trot eagerly, "if you think you can do it, and it would be safe to try."
"I'm pretty sure it is safe, the way I fixed my foot," said the sailor. "And if I should happen to get caught, I suppose the wizard could save me again."
"I suppose I could," agreed the wizard.
"Anyhow, if you wish to try it, Cap'n Bill, go ahead, and we'll stand by and watch what happens."
So the sailor man got upon the raft again and paddled over to the magic isle, landing as close to the golden flower pot as he could. They watched him walk across the land, put both arms around the flower pot, and lift it easily from its place. Then he carried it to the raft and set it down very gently. The removal did not seem to affect the magic flower in any way, for it was growing daffodils when Cap'n Bill picked it up, and on the way to the raft it grew tulips and gladioli.
During the time the sailor was paddling across the river to where his friends awaited him, seven different varieties of flowers bloomed in succession on the plant.
"I guess the magician who put it on the island never thought that anyone would carry it off," said Dorothy. "He figured that only men would want the plant, and any man who went upon the island to get it would be caught by the enchantment," said the wizard.
"After this," remarked Trot, "no one will care to go to the island, so it won't be a trap any more."
"There," exclaimed Cap'n Bill, setting down the magic plant in triumph upon the river bank. "If Ozma gets a better birthday present than that, I'd like to know what it can be."
"It'll surprise her, all right," declared Dorothy, standing in awed wonder before the glorious blossoms and watching them change from yellow roses to violets.
"It'll surprise everybody in the Emerald City," Trot asserted in glee, "and it'll be Ozma's present from Cap'n Bill and me."
"I think I ought to have a little credit," objected the Glass Cat. "I discovered the thing and led you to it, and brought the wizard here to save you when you got caught."
"That's true," admitted Trot, "and I'll tell Ozma the whole story, so she'll know how good you've been."
End of chapter 19. Chapter 20 of The Magic of Oz by L. Frank Baum. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 20. The Monkeys Have Trouble.
"Now," said the wizard, "we must start for home. But how are we going to carry that big gold flower pot? Cap'n Bill can't lug it all the way, that's certain."
"No," acknowledged the sailor man, "it's pretty heavy. I could carry it for a little while, but I'd have to stop to rest every few minutes."
"Couldn't we put it on your back?" Dorothy asked the Cowardly Lion with a good-natured yawn.
"I don't object to carrying it, if you can fasten it on," answered the lion.
"If it falls off," said Trot, "it might get smashed and be ruined."
"I'll fix it," promised Cap'n Bill. "I'll take a flat board out of one of those tree trunks and tie the board on the lion's back and set the flower pot on the board."
He set to work at once to do this, but as he only had his big knife for a tool, his progress was slow. So the wizard took from his black bag a tiny saw that shone like silver and said to it, "Saw, little saw, come show your power. Make us a board for the magic flower." And at once the little saw began to move, and it sawed the log so fast that those who watched it work were astonished. It seemed to understand, too, just what the board was to be used for when it was completed, it was flat on top and hollowed beneath in such a manner
that it exactly fitted the lion's back.
"That beats whittling," exclaimed Cap'n Bill admiringly. "You don't happen to have two of them saws, do you, wizard?"
"No," replied the wizard, wiping the magic saw carefully with his silk handkerchief and putting it back in the black bag. "It's the only saw of its kind in the world, and if there were more like it, it wouldn't be so wonderful." They now tied the board on the lion's back, flat side up, and Cap'n Bill carefully placed the magic flower on the board.
"For fear of accidents," he said, "I'll walk beside the lion and hold on to the flower pot."
Trot and Dorothy could both ride on the back of the hungry tiger, and between them they carried the cage of monkeys. But this arrangement left the wizard, as well as the sailor, to make the journey on foot, and so the procession moved slowly, and the Glass Cat grumbled because it would take so long to get to the Emerald City. The cat was sour-tempered and grumpy at first, but before they had journeyed far, the crystal creature had discovered a fine amusement. The long tails of the monkeys were constantly sticking through the bars of their cage, and when they did, the Glass Cat would slyly seize the tail in her paws and pull them. This made the monkeys scream, and their screams pleased the Glass Cat immensely. Trot and Dorothy tried to stop this naughty amusement, but when they were not looking, the cat would pull the tails again, and the creature was so sly and quick that the monkeys could seldom escape. They scolded the cat angrily and shook the bars of their cage, but they could not get out, and the cat only laughed at them. After the party had left the forest and were on the plains of the Munchkin Country, it grew dark, and they were obliged to make camp for the night, choosing a pretty place beside a brook. By means of his magic, the wizard created three tents pitched in a row on the grass and nicely fitted with all that was needful for the comfort of his comrades. The middle tent was for Dorothy and Trot, and had in it two cozy white beds and two chairs. Another tent, also with beds and chairs, was for the wizard and Cap'n Bill, while the third tent was for the hungry tiger, the cowardly lion, the cage of monkeys, and the Glass Cat. Outside the tents, the wizard made a fire and placed over it a magic kettle from which he presently drew all sorts of nice things for their supper, smoking hot. After they had eaten and talked together for a while under the twinkling stars, they all went to bed, and the people were soon asleep. The lion and the tiger had almost fallen asleep, too, when they were roused by the screams of the monkeys, for the Glass Cat was pulling their tails again. Annoyed by the uproar, the hungry tiger cried, "Stop that racket!" And getting sight of the Glass Cat, he raised his big paw and struck at the creature. The cat was quick enough to dodge the blow, but the claws of the hungry tiger scraped the monkey's cage and bent two of the bars. Then the tiger lay down again to sleep, but the monkeys soon discovered that the bending of the bars would allow them to squeeze through. They did not leave the cage, however, but after whispering together, they let their tails stick out and all remained quiet. Presently, the Glass Cat stole near the cage again and gave a yank to one of the tails. Instantly, the monkeys leaped through the bars one after another, and although they were so small, the entire dozen of them surrounded the Glass Cat and clung to her claws and tails and ears and made her a prisoner. Then they forced her out of the tent and down to the banks of the stream. The monkeys had noticed that these banks were covered with thick, slimy mud of a dark blue color, and when they had taken the cat to the stream, they smeared this mud all over the glass body of the cat, filling the creature's ears and eyes with it so that she could neither see nor hear. She was no longer transparent, and so thick was the mud upon her that no one could see her pink brains or her ruby heart. In this condition, they led the pussy back to the tent and then got inside their cage again. By morning, the mud had dried hard on the Glass Cat, and it was a dull blue color throughout. Dorothy and Trot were horrified, but the wizard shook his head and said it served the Glass Cat right for teasing the monkeys. Cap'n Bill, with his strong hands, soon bent the golden wires of the monkey's cage into the proper position, and then he asked the wizard if he should wash the Glass Cat in the water of the brook. "Not just yet," answered the wizard. "The cat deserves to be punished, so I think I'll leave that blue mud, which is as bad as paint, upon her body until she gets to the Emerald City. The silly creature is so vain that she will be greatly shamed when the Oz people see her in this condition, and perhaps she'll take the lesson to heart and leave the monkeys alone hereafter." However, the Glass Cat could not see or hear, and to avoid carrying her on the journey, the wizard picked the mud out of her eyes and ears, and Dorothy dampened her handkerchief and washed both the eyes and ears clean. As soon as she could speak, the Glass Cat asked indignantly,
"Aren't you going to punish those monkeys for playing such a trick on me?"
"No," answered the wizard. "You played a trick on them by pulling their tails, so this is only tit for tat, and I'm glad the monkeys had their revenge." He wouldn't allow the Glass Cat to go near the water to wash herself, but made her follow them when they resumed their journey toward the Emerald City. "This is only part of your punishment," said the wizard severely. "Ozma will laugh at you when we get to her palace, and so will the Scarecrow and the Tin Woodman and Tick-Tock and the Shaggy Man and Button-Bright and the Patchwork Girl and the Pink Kitten," added Dorothy. That suggestion hurt the Glass Cat more than anything else. The Pink Kitten always quarreled with the Glass Cat and insisted that flesh was superior to glass, while the Glass Cat would jeer at the Pink Kitten because it had no pink brains. But the pink brains were all daubed with blue mud just now, and if the Pink Kitten could see the Glass Cat in such a condition, it would be dreadfully humiliating. For several hours the Glass Cat walked along very meekly, but toward noon it seized an opportunity when no one was looking, and darted away through the long grass. It remembered that there was a tiny lake of pure water nearby, and to this lake the cat sped as fast as he could go. The others never missed her until they stopped for lunch, and then it was too late to hunt for her. "I spec she's gone somewhere to clean herself," said Dorothy. "Never mind," replied the wizard. "Perhaps this glass creature has been punished enough, and we must not forget she saved both Trot and Cap'n Bill." "After first leading them onto an enchanted island," added Dorothy. "But I think, as you do, that the Glass Cat is punished enough, and perhaps she won't try to pull the monkeys' tails again." The Glass Cat did not rejoin the party of travelers. She was still resentful, and they moved too slowly to suit her besides. When they arrived at the royal palace, one of the first things they saw was the Glass Cat, curled up on a bench as bright and clean and transparent as ever, but she pretended not to notice them, and they passed her by without remark. End of chapter 20. Chapter 21 of The Magic of Oz by L. Frank Baum. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 21. The College of Athletic Arts. Dorothy and her friends arrived at the royal palace at an opportune time, for Ozma was holding high court in her throne room, where Professor H. M. Wogglebug, T.E., was appealing to her to punish some of the students of the Royal Athletic College, of which he was the principal. This college is located in the Munchkin Country, not far from the Emerald City. To enable the students to devote their entire time to athletic exercises, such as boating, football, and the like,
Professor Wogglebug had invented an assortment of tablets of learning. One of these tablets, eaten by a scholar after breakfast, would instantly enable him to understand arithmetic or algebra or any other branch of mathematics. Another tablet, eaten after lunch, gave a student a complete knowledge of geography. Another tablet made it possible for the eater to spell the most difficult words, and still another enabled him to write a beautiful hand. There were tablets for history, mechanics, home cooking, and agriculture, and it mattered not whether a boy or girl was stupid or bright, for the tablets taught them everything in the twinkling of an eye. This method, which is patented in the Land of Oz by Professor Wogglebug, saves paper and books as well as the tedious hours devoted to study in some of our less favorite schools, and it also allows the students to devote all their time to racing, baseball, tennis, and other manly and womanly sports, which are greatly interfered with by study in those temples of learning where tablets of learning are unknown. But it so happened that Professor Wogglebug, who had invented so much that he had acquired the habit, carelessly invented a square meal tablet, which was no bigger than your little fingernail, but contained, in condensed form, the equal of a bowl of soup, a portion of fried fish, a roast, a salad, and a dessert, all of which gave the same nourishment as a square meal. The professor was so proud of these square meal tablets that he began to feed them to the students at his college instead of other food, but the boys and girls objected because they wanted food that they could enjoy the taste of. It was no fun at all to swallow a tablet with a glass of water and call it a dinner, so they refused to eat the square meal tablets. Professor Wogglebug insisted, and the result was that the senior class seized the learned professor one day and threw him into the river, clothes and all. Everyone knows that a Wogglebug cannot swim, and so the inventor of the wonderful square meal tablets lay helpless on the bottom of the river for 3 days before a fisherman caught one of his legs on a fish hook and dragged him out upon the bank. The learned professor was naturally indignant at such treatment, and so he brought the entire senior class to the Emerald City and appealed to Ozma of Oz to punish them for their rebellion. I do not suppose the girl ruler was very severe with the rebellious boys and girls, because she had herself refused to eat the square meal tablets in place of food, but while she listened to the interesting case in her throne room, Cap'n Bill managed to carry the golden flower pot containing the magic flower up to Trot's room without it being seen by anyone except Jellia Jamb, Ozma's chief maid of honor, and Jellia promised not to tell. Also, the wizard was able to carry the cage of monkeys up to one of the top towers of the palace, where he had a room of his own to which no one came unless invited. So Trot and Dorothy and Cap'n Bill and the wizard were all delighted at the successful end of their adventure. The Cowardly Lion and the Hungry Tiger went to the marble stables behind the royal palace, where they lived while at home, and they, too, kept the secret, even refusing to tell the Wooden Sawhorse and Hank the Mule and the Yellow Hen and the Pink Kitten where they had been. Trot watered the magic flower every day and allowed no one in her room to see the beautiful blossoms except her friends, Betsy Bobbin and Dorothy. The wonderful plant did not seem to lose any of its magic by being removed from its island, and Trot was sure that Ozma would prize it as one of her most delightful treasures. Up in his tower, the little Wizard of Oz began training his 12 tiny monkeys, and the little creatures were so intelligent that they learned every trick the wizard tried to teach them. The wizard treated them with great kindness and gentleness and gave them the food that monkeys love best, so they promised to do their best on the great occasion of Ozma's birthday. end of chapter 21. Chapter 22 of The Magic of Oz by L. Frank Baum. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 22, Ozma's Birthday Party. It seems odd that a fairy should have a birthday, for fairies, they say, were born at the beginning of time and live forever. Yet, on the other hand, it would be a shame to deprive a fairy, who has so many other good things, of the delights of a birthday. So we need not wonder that the fairies keep their birthdays just as other folks do, and consider them occasions for feasting and rejoicing. Ozma, the beautiful girl ruler of the fairyland of Oz, was a real fairy, and so sweet and gentle in caring for her people that she was greatly beloved by them all. She lived in the most beautiful palace in the most magnificent city in the world, but that did not prevent her from being the friend of the most humble person in her dominions. She would mount her wooden sawhorse and ride out to a farmhouse and sit in the kitchen to talk with the good wife of the farmer while she did her family baking. Or she would play with the children and give them rides on her famous wooden steed. Or she would stop in a forest to speak to a charcoal burner and ask if he was happy or desired anything to make him more content. Or she would teach young girls how to sew and plan pretty dresses, or enter the shops where the jewelers and craftsmen were busy and watch them at their work, giving to each and all a cheering word or a sunny smile. And then Ozma would sit in her jeweled throne with her closest courtiers all about her, and listen patiently to any complaint brought to her by her subjects, striving to accord equal justice to all. Knowing she was fair in her decisions, the Oz people never murmured at her judgments, but agreed if Ozma decided against them, she was right and they were wrong. When Dorothy and Trot and Betsy Bobbins and Ozma were together, one would think they were all of about an age, and the fairy ruler no older and no more grown-up than the other three. She would laugh and romp with them in regular girlish fashion. Yet there was an air of quiet dignity about Ozma, even in her merriest moods, that in a manner distinguished her from the others. The three girls loved her devotedly, but they were never able to quite forget that Ozma was the royal ruler of the wonderful fairyland of Oz, and by birth belonged to a powerful race. Ozma's palace stood in the center of a delightful and extensive garden, where splendid trees and flowering shrubs and statuary and fountains abounded. One could walk for hours in this fascinating park and see something interesting at every step. In one place was an aquarium where strange and beautiful fish swam. In another spot, all the birds of the air gathered daily to a great feast which Ozma's servants provided for them, and were so fearless of harm that they would alight upon one's shoulders and eat from one's hand. There was also the Fountain of the Water of Oblivion, but it was dangerous to drink of this water, because it made one forget everything he had ever before known, even to his own name, and therefore Ozma had placed a sign of warning upon the fountain. But there were also fountains that were delightfully perfumed, and fountains of delicious nectar, cool and richly flavored, where all were welcome to refresh themselves. Around the palace grounds was a great wall, thickly encrusted with glittering emeralds, but the gates stood open, and no one was forbidden entrance. On holidays, the people of the Emerald City often took their children to see the wonders of Ozma's gardens, and even entered the royal palace if they felt so inclined, for they knew that they and their ruler were friends, and that Ozma delighted to give them pleasure. When all this is considered,
You will not be surprised that the people throughout the land of Oz, as well as Ozma's most intimate friends and her royal courtiers, were eager to celebrate her birthday and made preparations for the festival weeks in advance. All the brass bands practiced their nicest tunes, for they were to march in the numerous processions to be made in the Winkie Country, the Gillikin Country, the Munchkin Country, and the Quadling Country, as well as in the Emerald City. Not all the people would go to congratulate their ruler, but all could celebrate her birthday in one way or another, however far distant from her palace they might be. Every home and building throughout the land of Oz was to be decorated with banners and bunting, and there was to be games and plays and a general good time for everyone. It was Ozma's custom on her birthday to give a grand feast at the palace, to which all her closest friends were invited. It was a queerly assorted company, indeed, for there were more quaint and unusual characters in Oz than in all the rest of the world, and Ozma was more interested in unusual people than in ordinary ones, just as you and I are. On this especial birthday of the lovely girl ruler, a long table was set in the royal banquet hall of the palace, at which were placed cards for the invited guests, and at one end of the great room was a smaller table, not so high, for Ozma's animal friends, whom she never forgot, and at the other end was a big table where all of the birthday gifts were to be arranged. When the guests arrived, they placed their gifts on the table, and then found their places at the banquet table, and after the guests were all placed, the animals entered in a solemn procession and were placed at their table by Jellia Jamb. Then, while an orchestra hidden by a bank of roses and ferns played a march composed for the occasion, the royal Ozma entered the banquet hall, attended by her maids of honor, and took her seat at the head of the table. She was greeted by a cheer from all the assembled company, the animals adding their roars and growls and barks and mewing and cackling to swell the glad tumult, and then all seated themselves at their tables. At Ozma's right sat the famous Scarecrow of Oz, whose straw-stuffed body was not beautiful, but whose happy nature and shrewd wit had made him a general favorite. On the left of the ruler was placed the Tin Woodman, whose metal body had been brightly polished for this event. The Tin Woodman was the Emperor of the Winkie Country, and one of the most important persons in Oz. Next to the Scarecrow, Dorothy was seated, and next to her was Tick-Tock the Clockwork Man, who had been wound up as tightly as his clockwork would permit, so he wouldn't interrupt the festivities by running down. Then came Aunt Em and Uncle Henry, Dorothy's own relations, two kindly old people who had a cozy home in the Emerald City, and were very happy and contented there. Then Betsy Bobbin was seated, and next to her the droll and delightful Shaggy Man, who was a favorite wherever he went. On the other side of the table, opposite the Tin Woodman, was placed Trot, and next to her Cap'n Bill. Then was seated Button Bright, and Ojo the Lucky, and Dr. Pipt, and his good wife Margalot, and the astonishing Frogman, who had come from the Yip Country to be present at Ozma's birthday feast. At the foot of the table, facing Ozma, was seated the queenly Glinda, the good sorceress of Oz, for this was really the place of honor next to the head of the table, where Ozma herself sat. On Glinda's right was the little Wizard of Oz, who owed to Glinda all of the magical arts he knew. Then came Ginger, a pretty girl farmer, of whom Ozma and Dorothy were quite fond. The adjoining seat was occupied by the Tin Soldier, and next to him was Professor H. M. Wogglebug, T.E. of the Royal Athletic College. On Glinda's left was placed the Jolly Patchwork Girl, who was a little afraid of the sorceress, and so was likely to behave herself pretty well.
The shaggy man's brother was beside the patchwork girl, and then came that interesting personage, Jack Pumpkinhead, who had grown a splendid big pumpkin for a new head to be worn on Ozma's birthday, and had carved a face on it that was even jollier in expression than the one he had last worn. New heads were not unusual with Jack, for the pumpkins did not keep long, and when the seeds, which served him as brains, began to get soft and mushy, he realized his head would soon spoil, and so he procured a new one from his great field of pumpkins, grown by him so that he would never lack a head. You will have noticed that the company at Ozma's banquet table was somewhat mixed, but everyone invited was a tried and trusted friend of the girl ruler, and their presence made her quite happy. No sooner had Ozma seated herself with her back to the birthday table than she noticed that all present were eyeing with curiosity and pleasure something behind her, for the gorgeous magic flower was blooming gloriously, and the mammoth blossoms that quickly succeeded one another on the plant were beautiful to view, and filled the entire room with their delicate fragrance. Ozma wanted to look, too, to see what all were staring at, but she controlled her curiosity because it was not proper that she should yet view her birthday gifts. So the sweet and lovely ruler devoted herself to her guests, several of whom, such as the Scarecrow, the Tin Woodman, the Patchwork Girl, Tick-Tock, Jack Pumpkinhead, and the Tin Soldier, never ate anything but sat very politely in their places and tried to entertain those of the guests who did eat. And at the animal table there was another interesting group consisting of the Cowardly Lion, the Hungry Tiger, Toto, Dorothy's little shaggy black dog, Hank the Mule, the Pink Kitten, the Wooden Sawhorse, the Yellow Hen, and the Glass Cat. All of these had good appetites, except the Sawhorse and the Glass Cat, and each was given a plentiful supply of the food it liked best. Finally, when the banquet was nearly over and the ice cream was to be served, four servants entered bearing a huge cake, all frosted and decorated with candy flowers. Around the edge of the cake was a row of lighted candles, and in the center were raised candy letters that spelled the words, "Ozma's Birthday Cake from Dorothy and the Wizard." "Oh, how beautiful!" cried Ozma, greatly delighted. And Dorothy said eagerly, "Now you must cut the cake, Ozma, and each of us will eat a piece with our ice cream." Jellia Jam brought a large golden knife with a jeweled handle, and Ozma stood up in her place and attempted to cut the cake. But as soon as the frosting in the center broke under the pressure of the knife, there leaped from the cake a tiny monkey 3 inches high, and he was followed by another and another, until 12 monkeys stood on the tablecloth and bowed low to Ozma.
"Congratulations to our gracious ruler!" they exclaimed in a chorus, and then they began a dance so droll and amusing that all the company roared with laughter, and even Ozma joined in the merriment. But after the dance the monkeys performed some wonderful acrobatic feats, and then they ran to the hollow of the cake and took out some band instruments of burnished gold, cornets, horns, drums, and the like, and forming into a procession, the monkeys marched up and down the table playing a jolly tune with the ease of skilled musicians. Dorothy was delighted with the success of her surprise cake, and after the monkeys had finished their performance, the banquet came to an end. Now was the time for Ozma to see her other presents. So Glinda the Good rose, and, taking the girl ruler by her hand, led her to the table where all her gifts were placed in a magnificent array. The magic flower, of course, attracted her attention first, and Trot had to tell her the whole story of their adventures in getting it. The little girl did not forget to give due credit to the Glass Cat and the little wizard.
but it was really Cap'n Bill who had bravely carried the golden flower pot away from the Enchanted Isle. Ozma thanked them all and said she would place the magic flower in her boudoir where she might enjoy its beauty and fragrance continually. But now she discovered the marvelous gown woven by Glinda and her maidens from strands drawn from pure emeralds, and being a girl who loved pretty clothes, Ozma's ecstasy at being presented with this exquisite gown may well be imagined. She could hardly wait to put it on, but the table was loaded with other pretty gifts, and the night was far spent before the happy girl ruler had examined all her presents and thanked those who had lovingly donated them. End of chapter 22. Chapter 23 of The Magic of Oz by L. Frank Baum. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 23, The Fountain of Oblivion. The morning after the birthday fete, as the wizard and Dorothy were walking in the grounds of the palace, Ozma came out and joined them, saying, "I want to hear more of your adventures in the forest of Gugu, and how you were able to get those dear little monkeys to use in Dorothy's surprise cake." So they sat down on a marble bench near to the Fountain of the Water of Oblivion, and between them Dorothy and the wizard related their adventures. "I was dreadfully fussy while I was a woolly lamb," said Dorothy, "for it didn't feel good a bit, and I wasn't quite sure, you know, that I'd ever get to be a girl again." "You might have been a woolly lamb yet, if I hadn't happened to have discovered that magic transformation word," declared the wizard. "But what became of the walnut and the hickory nut, into which you transformed those dreadful beast magicians?" inquired Ozma. "Why, I'd almost forgotten them," was the reply. "But I believe they are still here in my pocket." Then he searched in his pockets and brought out the two nuts and showed them to her. Ozma regarded them thoughtfully. "It isn't right to leave any living creatures in such helpless forms," said she. "I think, wizard, you ought to transform them into their natural shapes again." "But I don't know what their natural shapes are," he objected. "For, of course, the forms of mixed animals which they had assumed were not natural to them. And you must not forget, Ozma, that their natures were cruel and mischievous. So if I bring them back to life, they might cause us a great deal of trouble." "Nevertheless," said the ruler of Oz, "we must free them from their present enchantments. When you restore them to their natural forms, we will discover who they really are, and surely we need not fear any two people, even though they prove to be magicians and our enemies." "I am not so sure of that," protested the wizard with a shake of his bald head. "That one bit of magic I robbed them of, which was the word of transformation, is so simple yet so powerful that neither Glinda nor I can equal it. It isn't all in the word, you know, it's the way the word is pronounced. So if the two strange magicians have other magic of the same sort, they might prove very dangerous to us if we liberated them." "I've an idea," exclaimed Dorothy. "I'm no wizard and no fairy, but if you do as I say, we needn't fear these people at all." "What is your thought, my dear?" asked Ozma. "Well," replied the girl, "here is this Fountain of the Water of Oblivion, and that's what put the notion into my head. When the wizard speaks that terrible word that will change 'em back to their real forms, he can make 'em dreadfully thirsty, too, and we'll put a cup right there by the fountain so it'll be handy. Then they'll drink the water and forget all the magic they ever knew, and everything else, too." "That's not a bad idea," said the wizard, looking at Dorothy approvingly. "It's a very good idea," declared Ozma. "Run for a cup, Dorothy." So Dorothy ran to get a cup, and while she was gone, the wizard said, "I don't know whether the real forms of these magicians are those of men or beasts,
If they're beasts, they would not drink from a cup, but might attack us at once and drink afterward. So it might be safer for us to have the Cowardly Lion and the Hungry Tiger here to protect us if necessary." Ozma drew out a silver whistle, which was attached to a slender gold chain, and blew upon the whistle two shrill blasts. The sound, though not harsh, was very penetrating, and as soon as it reached the ears of the Cowardly Lion and the Hungry Tiger, the two huge beasts quickly came bounding toward them. Ozma explained to them what the wizard was about to do, and told them to keep quiet unless danger threatened. So the two powerful guardians of the ruler of Oz crouched beside the fountain and waited. Dorothy returned and set the cup on the edge of the fountain. Then the wizard placed the hickory nut beside the fountain and said in a solemn voice, "I want you to resume your natural form and to be very thirsty. Here's a quixel." In an instant, there appeared in the place of the hickory nut the form of Kiki Aru, the high-up boy. He seemed bewildered at first, as if trying to remember what had happened to him and why he was in this strange place. But he was facing the fountain, and the bubbling water reminded him that he was thirsty. Without noticing Ozma, the wizard, and Dorothy, who were behind him, he picked up the cup, filled it with the water of oblivion, and drank it to the last drop. He was now no longer thirsty, but he felt more bewildered than ever, for now he could remember nothing at all, not even his name or where he came from. He looked around the beautiful garden with a pleased expression, and then, turning, he beheld Ozma and the wizard and Dorothy regarding him curiously, and the two great beasts crouching behind them. Kiki Aru did not know who they were, but he thought Ozma very lovely and Dorothy very pleasant. So he smiled at them, the same innocent, happy smile that a baby might have indulged in, and that pleased Dorothy, who seized his hand and led him to a seat beside her on the bench. "Why, I thought you were a dreadful magician," she exclaimed, "and you're only a boy." "What is a magician?" he asked. "And what is a boy?" "Don't you know?" inquired the girl. Kiki shook his head. Then he laughed. "I do not seem to know anything," he replied. "It's very curious," remarked the wizard. "He wears the dress of the Munchkins, so he must have lived at one time in the Munchkin country. Of course, the boy can tell us nothing of his history or his family, for he has forgotten all that he ever knew. He seems a nice boy, now that all the wickedness has gone from him," said Ozma. "So we will keep him here with us and teach him our ways, to be true and considerate of others." "Why, in that case, it's lucky for him he drank the water of oblivion," said Dorothy.
"It is indeed," agreed the wizard. "But the remarkable thing to me is how such a young boy ever learned the secret of the magic word of transformation. Perhaps his companion, who is at present this walnut, was the real magician, although I seem to remember that it was this boy in the beast's form who whispered the magic word into the hollow tree where I overheard it." "Well, we will soon know who the other is," suggested Ozma. "He may prove to be another Munchkin boy." The wizard placed the walnut near the fountain and said, as slowly and solemnly as before, "I want you to resume your natural form and to be very thirsty. Here's a quixel." Then the walnut disappeared, and Ruggedo the gnome stood in its place. He also was facing the fountain, and he reached for the cup, filled it, and was about to drink when Dorothy exclaimed, "Why, it's the old Gnome King!" Ruggedo swung around and faced them, the cup still in his hand. "Yes," he said in an angry voice, "it's the old Gnome King, and I'm going to conquer all Oz and be revenged on you for kicking me out of my throne." He looked around for a moment and then continued, "There isn't an egg in sight, and I'm stronger than all of you people put together.
I don't know how I came here, but I'm willing to fight the fight of my life, and I'll win." His long white hair and beard waved in the breeze. His eyes flashed hate and vengeance. And so astonished and shocked were they by the sudden appearance of this old enemy of the Oz people that they could only stare at him in silence and shrink away from his wild glare. Ruggedo laughed. He drank the water, threw the cup on the ground, and said fiercely, His voice grew gentle. He rubbed his forehead with a puzzled air and stroked his long beard. "What was I going to say?" he asked pleadingly. "Don't you remember?" said the wizard. "No, I've forgotten." "Who are you?" asked Dorothy. He tried to think. I'm sure I don't know," he stammered. "Don't you know who we are either?" questioned the girl. "I haven't the slightest idea," said the gnome. "Tell us who this Munchkin boy is," suggested Ozma. Ruggedo looked at the boy and shook his head. "He's a stranger to me. You are all strangers. I'm a stranger to myself," he said. Then he patted the lion's head and murmured, "Good doggy," and the lion growled indignantly. "What shall we do with him?" asked the wizard, perplexed. "Once before, the wicked old gnome came here to conquer us, and then, as now, he drank of the water of oblivion and became harmless. But we sent him back to the Gnome Kingdom, where he soon learned the old evil ways again." "For that reason," said Ozma, "we must find a place for him in the Land of Oz and keep him here. For here he can learn no evil and will always be as innocent of guile as our own people." And so the wandering ex-king of the gnomes found a new home, a peaceful and happy home, where he was quite content and passed his days in innocent enjoyment. End of chapter 23. End of The Magic of Oz by L. Frank Baum. This book has been recorded by Phil Chenevert, Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.